I'm Brett, and I'm joined as
And
usual by
or Travers.
Travers, there we go. Sorry, man.
Yeah.
I'm all like discombobulated today. I was trying to change the I was doing multitasking is never a good idea. So I was trying to change the category in Twitch. I was trying to get my cheat sheet up, and yeah.
Yep.
It worked out really well, as you can tell. I did not change the category. I could not figure out how to do it. It's like stress. I was under pressure to try to figure it out. All right, perfect. Well, with all the shenanigans out of the way, let's jump in. First update is around Q. So we now have inline completions in the command line. So this, it doesn't support everything, if I understand this right. Like you can do at git commands and things like that. It'll kind of auto-populate it. I kind of threw this in here because I use this all the time, and I kind of always thought it had auto completion because I know
in
when
the
I've
CLI.
Got yeah in the CLI when I've got the QCLI running, like it auto populates or auto completes my git commands and stuff like that. So this one took me a little bit by surprise, but maybe I'm misunderstanding this one. I don't know.
Maybe. It seems pretty smart. Yeah, if you type git, a developer might suggest a push origin main. Okay, so it's just suggestions in your CLI.
Yeah, and it's kind of neat, right? Like you can see in the second paragraph here, it says it looks at your current shell context, looks at your shell history to kind of try to figure out maybe what you're intending for that to be. I don't know. Sometimes I'm a little confused on this because I know, remember this used to be called Code Whisperer, right? So originally it was Code Whisperer CLI. Before that, Code Whisperer CLI, my understanding is actually came from a different company. It used to be called Fig, and it was like a little, remember that? And I was still am a huge fan of Fig. So I don't know, maybe is it Fig in the background? Like maybe I didn't.
I wouldn't be surprised.
Uninstall something properly, so that's why I'm just kind of. But it already does this. I don't know.
Like on your personal.
Yeah, like on my personal.
Yeah, maybe.
Is it still running somehow? And I don't realize that I'm now running Fig and Amazon QCLI. I have no idea.
Maybe they finally integrated that feature with.
Yeah, I no longer have a Fig icon anywhere because I was looking today before the podcast, but now I'm confusing myself as we talk about this. You know, one thing I stumbled across, though, in the I can never remember the names now because they keep changing them. Amazon Q CLI. You've got a chat option right in your CLI now.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, so I didn't know you could do that.
Is it just puts you into like a kind of interactive prompt situation?
You got it. So like you type Q login and it gives you a prompt and it says, okay, how do you want to log in? You can do use your builder ID, which is the most confusing thing that I think I've ever seen, but that's for another podcast. So you've got builder ID. And in our case, we pay for it. So I go down to Identity Center or whatever, logs me in. And once I'm logged in, I can type Q chat and it gives me a little chat window and I can say, could you help me figure out X or Y or whatever? And it's just right in your CLI, which I stumbled across this week. I don't even know how I managed to stumble across it. So that's kind of why I put this one in here to just highlight sort of some of the features and functionality. This is pretty cool. And to be honest, the info I was getting back when I was running the little Q CLI or Q chat commands was pretty good. So
that's good. Yeah. Well, you know, pending any phantom CLI tools you may have running in the background,
maybe
you can now autocorrect on or suggest on Q.
Yeah. Yeah. It seemed okay. You know, the other thing that I kind of grumpy about, but that they need to figure out somehow is if I'm in my IDE, and again, maybe this is probably user error. When I'm in my IDE, Amazon Q, I've logged out there. I'm like it auto times out, right? So I've got to re-authenticate, but then as far as I can tell, I've authenticated in Amazon Q CLI, but they're two separate things. Mm-hmm. So then I got to keep authenticating all over the place. I don't know,
Multiple tokens, multiple sessions, it looks like. Yeah.
Yeah, it must be going on something like that. So anyways, I would suggest that you try this. I think that Amazon Q the CLI portion, my memory is that it's not supported on Windows yet. I think it's like a Linux and Mac thing
only.
Yeah, but you could always check and see if you're interested in trying it out. I like it. I've used it once I discovered the QChat thing. I've been using it this week quite a lot, actually, and just to try to test it out. And yeah, I've thought it's been pretty adequate, at least pointing me in the right direction, right?
Right.
Yeah.
If you're working in the CLI all the time, it's good for that context.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's that. What else do we have? Here's another one that kind of caught me by surprise. You can now increase your integration timeout limits on the API gateway beyond 29 seconds.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay. Because that used to be a hard limit. You couldn't have any tasks running beyond that. You'd have to fire off an API call to kind of kick off a process and then send a response that, hey, the process has been kicked off, or we've added this to your database or whatnot. But you couldn't just kind of wait for a response for that long.
Yeah.
So that's interesting.
Yeah. You know what? I guess that's okay. The only thing that kind of surprised me about this, or not surprised me, I'm like, oh great. So now we're going to have, it'll be like, I could write an API to make a call out to a service, and it could just, instead of being a nice efficient call, I could go past 30 seconds now. So do I do I care if it's 5 minutes or 15 seconds?
There's no hand-holding for kind of practices anymore of that.
Yeah.
I wonder if there's like a WebSocket situation where that's useful. I don't know. That just maybe. Have to look into that, I suppose.
Yeah, maybe. For me, it's kind of a little bit of incentive to try to make it more efficient.
Oh, yeah.
You know, but you'll notice here, I'll highlight this. When you think about it this way, it does actually maybe make a lot of sense to do this. So you can see customers requiring longer timeouts, like Gen AI use cases and stuff like that. Right. Then you can now put the API gateway in front of it, which you couldn't before.
So. Oh, yeah. And they call out WebSockets in the next paragraph, actually. So that's probably the main use case for that kind of thing.
Yeah. So interesting. Just kind of thought I'd throw it in there. Health imaging. Whenever I see event-driven programming stuff, I'm immediately like, ooh, what is that? Let's go look. not that we use health imaging for anything or even talk to a customer about it, right? But
it's kind of amazing that there's services out there still that we haven't heard of, but I've never heard of health imaging before. What does that service even do? Is it specifically for x-rays or?
Store, analyze, and share medical images in the cloud at petabyte scale.
For x-rays and MRIs.
Yeah.
Fascinating.
Yeah. Who knew, right? It's kind of, I've always described, ever since I started working in AWS, I've always described the number of services as a little bit of a double-edged sword. It's fantastic that you can go out and do like all these great things, but it's also challenging because you're like, what is this? I have no idea. So... Yeah, I think it's kind of, it makes a lot of sense. Again, I guess if we think about asynchronous processing, building sort of event-driven applications, now maybe something happens in health imaging, you publish an event to EventBridge and you can kind of kick off another workflow or something like that, depending on what you're doing. So kind of neat.
Yeah, you like upload a batch of images and then pipe it off to some sort of processing pipeline or some sort of, something that'll scan the images maybe and give you data on them.
Yeah, it kind of reminded me. Remember, it was a while ago. We worked with that customer on a very small POC where we were using Textract at the time to chew through applications, right, and pull information out and stuff, and sort of this whole idea of PDF processing, pushing them off into a queue or an event or something like that. Kind of when I saw this, it kind of reminded me of that POC that we did a few years back.
Oh yeah,
kind of neat. Oh, now I've got medical imaging. Let's try this one. And here's a good one. This one was interesting to me because Titan Text is the, I think it's a relatively newer model, if I remember, that's been made available on Bedrock.
Yeah.
And now you can also use it as part of your knowledge base. Because I know when we were doing the Let's Build session on using CloudFormation to build out custom knowledge bases and stuff. One of the things that I learned there was that you've got I'm going to mess up the terminology here, but you've got, I think it's called an embedding vector or something like that. So basically what you do is you had a smaller number of models that you could use as your embedding vector, I guess to put the data into the database or something like that. I don't quite understand exactly what it was for, but then you could use again supported models on the other side to actually start communicating and with
Yeah,
your bedrock knowledge base. So this is just extending that, I guess.
it's for reg specifically. It's how you pull data out of the databases to use vectors. Although they did say that you could use natural language recently. I know we covered that in one of the other episodes.
So I just thought I'd add this one. I might actually try this out because I've got the CloudFormation templates to build all this stuff, and I think I did the good old parameter with allowed values, so you could just either if you're in the console, just select the drop down and click it, or if you're doing it programmatically, you could just say this is the model I want to use. So I put it on my to-do list to go back and have a look and just make sure I understand this one and could I update the templates to include another model?
Yeah, worth
Cool.
trying.
Yeah, worth trying, right? And then I wanted to so try this before the call today, and I got distracted doing a bunch of things. I don't know about you, but I spend a fair amount of my time reading logs still. So as much as things change, things don't change. So
That's
anytime I'm
ideal.
like, ooh, live tailing logs, this is cool. So I wanted to give it a whirl. But I thought this was kind of neat. You can use it through the management console. You can use it programmatically. It even says here that you can build these live streams right into your own custom dashboards, or maybe if you're building something outside of AWS. So kind of neat, and I would suspect if you're troubleshooting things, this would be handy, right? To just do a live tail if you're starting to run something and you want to see what's happening.
I actually have been using this for a
Oh, have you?
customer writing that DynamoDB upload script for their processing their documents. So
Okay, so
yeah,
tell
it's
me about
useful
it
for.
then. How are you using it?
So you can you basically you plug into the log group, right?
Yep.
And you're it's essentially a tail. It shows you
Okay.
the output. So I've been using it for a Lambda function. So it writes logs to CloudWatch, and then you can see that as it comes up. So it's
Okay.
processing quite a few items in a CSV, essentially, right? So
Yeah, nice. So
it
you can
kind of
sit there
do.
and basically just stream the logs as you're troubleshooting or trying to figure out if it's doing what you would expect it to do. Is that how you're using it right now? Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, very neat. I wouldn't be surprised since it's got both CLI and programmatic support that people very quickly will write some applications to look for specific things in LiveTail and jam them in somewhere else,
Oh yeah,
right?
I'm sure.
Yeah. Perfect. So that's that one. And speaking of wanting to try something before the podcast and not having an opportunity to do it, I made myself a little note in the cheat sheet. Remember, I think it was last week, we talked about the new feature in CloudFormation where when you have a stack deploy or a stack update that fails, you can see
Oh, yep.
root cause, and now they have integration into
Directly to
CloudTrail.
CloudTrail,
Yeah.
right?
Yeah. So I tried it a couple times last week because like reading logs, I spend a lot of my time trying to figure out why a CloudFormation template isn't working. And to be
Was it helpful?
honest, nah.
Yeah.
Nah.
Is you kind of figure you know what API call is failing, right? It's the this resource
Yeah.
didn't create.
Yeah. Like, I was working on a WAF implementation. That's what I was doing. So I was building out some custom rules for a WAF implementation, and it failed. And it gave me the classic old CloudFormation error message. It was like, yeah, this didn't work. I'm like, geez, thanks. So I was like, wait, I will use this new integration. So first thing, I'm like, detect root cause, which is the silliest thing ever because I could just scroll through and see where it says error, and it's going to be the first error in the list that's root cause, right? But anyways, I click the detect root cause, and it goes down for me and finds the line. And then it's got a little link that you can click to go to CloudTrail. And okay, first thing, CloudTrail is not real time. So you click it and it's like, man, hang on a second. I don't know yet. try again later. So I was like, all right, well,
wait
I'll,
5 minutes.
Yeah, I'll wait. I'll go grab a coffee or whatever and come back. And I just want to see what this does. It is actually really interesting in the fact that I clicked the button. Once the logs were available in CloudTrail, I clicked the button and it gave me a nice little summary view of all the API calls that had been made.
Okay.
Okay. The problem is that the error that I had, and you know, I did something stupid. I went back and I was troubleshooting and I figured it out and I, you know, used my favorite Gen AI assistant to kind of help me logic it out and point me in a direction at least, which was actually really good. But I didn't take great notes. So today I'm like, okay, let's make a comment on this and go back. And I was racking my brain before the call today. I was like, what was the actual, like, how did I fix that? And I couldn't, just could not recall. I'm a little sleep deprived this week. I just couldn't recall what I had done. But my point is that I'm trying to make poorly at this point was, I think to your point earlier on, if it was just a permissions issue, you didn't, like, either you running the CloudFormation template or the entity that you're having run the template doesn't have the permissions to create an EC2 instance, it's at least going to tell you this is the API call that it made and you got access denied. In my case, I'm going to go back in Git and I'm going to find what I did wrong in the previous versions to try to recall. But in my case, it was neat, but it didn't end up helping me solve anything. But I
probably you're still hooped for KMS thing, security related problems.
This was like I'm pretty sure I copied it down somewhere, but it was like one of those really helpful extraneous name parameter value is not allowed. And I'm like, what? So my immediate reaction was, oh, you've got a tabbing issue, like in the YAML file, right? I cut and pasted something or whatever, and it just went, oop, over a tab. So I went through and checked all the tabs. I'm like, nope. I can't remember how I fixed it now.
Or something.
Yeah, like just, you know, how you can kind of get. Yeah, yeah. But I couldn't find it. I don't remember how I fixed it, but I can tell you that the detect root cause, use go to CloudTrail and look at it, feels kind of gimmicky to me, but I don't know. Maybe at some point I'll find some real value from it. But my first sort of pass on it was, meh.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, that sounds about right.
Yeah. Yeah. I like the idea of it. And I think to the point, like, if it's just a straight permissions issue, there's probably a lot of value there because it's going to tell you exactly what went wrong because CloudTrail is going to record that. Or maybe I'm missing the mark again here, which wouldn't surprise me if I'm just misunderstanding sort of the intent.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. It kind of sounds like it might actually have been some kind of template formatting issue instead, right? Not necessarily a CloudTrail thing CloudTrail would have helped you with.
Yeah. And in those kinds of cases, at least in my experience, most times when CloudFormation is not happy, for me, it's either a typo in the template. So if you've ever watched any of the streams, you know how often I misspell something. So it's a misspelling on a attribute name or a property definition or something like that. Or it's like a tabbing issue. And in those situations, CloudTrail's not going to tell you anything.
Won't do anything. Yeah, won't do anything for you.
No. But it was kind of neat that I could just click through it and see all the API calls that were made on my behalf through the CloudFormation. So kind of neat.
And I wonder, is it still attached after the stack's deleted? Like, I know you can go back and look at your deleted stacks, right? So I wonder if you could still go in and check that after a while, if it would point to the same location in the logs.
Oh, yeah, I don't know. The other thing is, it'd be interesting if maybe you don't delete the stack, but you fix your problem and you do an update and it runs clean. You would be able to go back in the event history for a certain amount of time and still see that root cause issue that you had before. I wonder if, you know, a day later, let's say it's still there, I wonder if you could click it and go back to CloudFormation and find it. I don't know.
Yeah,
I like the idea, or said CloudFormation, I meant CloudTrail. I like the idea of it being able to just sort of zero in for you in CloudTrail, because we talked about it last week or the week before, right? About some of the challenges of looking for things in CloudTrail through the console.
Searches.
Yeah,
searches. Not intuitive specifically.
Yeah. Yeah. So that was kind of neat. Okay, perfect. So those are all the AWS updates that I gathered up from the previous week that I thought all were right. interesting. Let's change gears and talk a little bit about some Gen AI news. So this is the first article that I came across. And this is kind of a theme that you and I have talked about quite often, is the fact that smaller organizations using Gen AI tools to kind of level the playing field here against larger organizations. So this article just kind of gives a couple examples on, you know, businesses that were having a problem and then sort of how they fixed that issue using Gen AI tools. A couple comments that I wrote down here is the first example, I guess it all depends what you define as a small and medium sized business. Like the first example is a 45 employee business. I don't know. In the Canadian market, would you consider that a small and medium sized business? I don't know. So it struck me that was awfully large.
It's a little subjective, right, to where you're operating.
Yeah.
But would that be, in Amazon's terms, that would be like that would be a small business?
They probably call it a startup.
They probably do. Yeah.
Yeah. It would be on the smaller end, I think, if I remember sort of how their definitions work. The other thing that kind of jumped out at me, I think two of the three examples they gave you. So basically what they did was they have three different companies. And they would say, here's the company, or here's the problem that the company faced. Here's how they fixed it. So in two of the three examples they have in the article, they clearly call out that the customers used, or the employees, whatever they are, use ChatGPT to fix the problem. And in general, the theme was the same. They typically used the Gen AI tool to help them brainstorm, get ideas on maybe how to solve a challenge that they were having. And then sort of use that as a starting point to maybe then, we talked about sort of this idea of Gen AI CEOs and stuff like that, right? Use that as sort of a brainstorming idea generation tool, and then worked with their teams internally to kind of extend what they got from the AI tools to kind of go out and find solutions. So that was the one thing I noticed. The other thing that I thought was interesting is in one of the examples, the person used ChatGPT again to solve the problem that they had. Okay. But then they went back and extended or created their own custom GPT to help them with something that was time consuming in their own business. So I thought that was kind of interesting on how started one way and then sort of built on top of that once they realized there was value there. So kind of neat.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, it's kind of that nebulous jagged frontier situation again, right? Like, it's hard to know what exactly the efficiency gains you're going to get from these systems, but they're really good at getting you started on a task, maybe pointing you in the right direction.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head with this, is it's like pointing you in a direction. I don't know about you, but sometimes I can get a little overwhelmed on the number of things that sort of on your to-do list, or if you get really bogged down troubleshooting, sometimes, at least for me, I'm like, geez, I've done everything I could possibly think of. What now? Right. And I have used multiple tools just to say, this is what I'm seeing. Give it a little bit of context. Could you help me solve this? And what I've noticed a couple times when I've done that is whether it ends up being the solution to my problem, it makes me think about it in a way that maybe I hadn't considered myself until I ran out of, like, these are the five things I want to try. Now what? It gave me some interesting ideas on a direction that I hadn't thought of. So that's pretty interesting. Sure. Yeah. The other thing that kind of grabbed my attention on this, ChatGPT, OpenAI, seems to be the tool that most people seem to be talking about. And I just wonder,
they won the mind share, right?
Like
the early adopter.
Yeah. The early adopter.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's going to be interesting to see how everybody else, I think we had this same conversation where we were talking about GPUs and NVIDIA and stuff, right? Like, how does everybody else carve out their little slice of some of this airtime because it all seems to be OpenAI and ChatGPT.
Yeah, that's going to be key, right? And I mean, I think Amazon, I mean, like we said, they're going wide. They want to provide the platform for you to build on. Google is just trying to integrate it into their search, make it as ubiquitous as they can. So there's a bunch of strategies. Facebook's implementing it in all of their social platforms, their Instagram Reels, that kind of stuff. So, yeah.
It'll be interesting to see how it goes. But I think most people, when they think about Gen AI, and I know this is an overgeneralization, I think if you were to do like sort of a back of the napkin survey, brand recognition and stuff like that, I bet you most
Yeah.
people would be able to tell you about OpenAI and ChatGPT. I wonder what the fall off would be from that to the others, right?
I bet it would be a Family Feud, like 80 people said
Yeah,
ChatGPT.
we asked 100 people.
Yeah.
The top four answers are on the board. Okay, so that I this is worth a read, and I think the interesting part about this article is how you can use this tool, regardless of the size of the organization,
Right.
to brainstorm, to give you ideas, point you in directions that maybe you hadn't thought of. I think there's tons of value there.
Yeah, it's not something that's easily predictable how much value or what you might get, what tasks you might get value on, right? So.
And I'm going to skip over this one. We're going to come back to that one. This one here, because we're Canadian. So Anthropic now is made Claude or Claude available in Canada, which means you can use the Claude AI web-based version. There's an iOS app. There's a Claude
Okay.
API, and then there's a plan that you can purchase now if you're in Canada.
Gotcha.
My first reaction with it was really I didn't know it wasn't available in Canada, but then I thought about it for a second. I'm like, well, wait, dumbass, you've been using Bedrock, so I've got access to all these models, so I've never really even considered going out and saying I'll make a purchase of like a subscription of Claude because I've just been using it anyways in Bedrock. So this caught me a little by surprise. I might subscribe to this. It's $28 Canadian plus tax, which I guess is maybe a li in line with OpenAI and ChatGPT. You get access to all of the models, Opus, Sonnet, and Haiku. And then there's a team plan, which I don't quite understand. There's an uplift of roughly $17 per user per month on the team plan, and you must have at least five seats. I didn't look at the feature sets and comparison and stuff, so wonder what do you get for the extra 17-ish bucks a month to have a team plan?
Right.
I might subscribe to this, and I'll explain why here as we go to the other slide, just to try it, right? Just to
Oh,
see what
sure.
it's like, right?
Yeah, I mean, wonder what the difference. I mean, I guess they have. Is it a dedicated chat app like ChatGPT they
I
give you
think
access
so.
to pretty much?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. The
Okay.
only crappy part about what I saw on this, I was like, oh, okay, I've got an app on my phone. I have a Pixel. So no app for me. So
Right.
you immediately lose some of the value there. I can tell you, speaking of OpenAI and ChatGPT, Karen laughs at me. Like, I walk around snapping pictures of everything on my phone now and asking
Oh, yeah.
ChatGPT what it is, particularly plants and stuff like that. So having that assistant on your phone, I can see a lot of value there. I'm sure they'll introduce it on other platforms, right? Makes sense to have it on other
Yeah, for sure.
platforms,
We'd
but so I
they'll get
just
it to Android eventually, surely.
Oh yeah, I would think so, right? So I might try this out just to see what it's like. And that's an actually nice segue into this guy. So Anthropic is now introducing agents, bots, whatever you want to call them now.
Okay.
And that's sort of tied to the other thing here where they said, I thought they had, maybe I'm getting confused with another reference or note, but I kind of thought somewhere I had read about those agents or bots being available. So this is, again, nothing new here, but you're now able to create assistants using Anthropic models with Claude, and you can actually access these models or these this functionality directly through Anthropic's API, through Bedrock, and through Google. So I thought that might be interesting. We could try it out and see how it works.
For sure. Yeah, this is definitely more compelling. I mean, the agents are going to be the next thing, right? So if you can use them easier or better on Anthropic's platform, then that's a win for them.
So we keep saying agents are going to be the next thing. Agents are going to be the next thing. And I see lots of really interesting YouTube videos about it. And look at I have these agents doing all this work for me. I'm still having a hard time with the value prop of some of this stuff. But I guess more options is always good. I think the challenge here is, do you get so bogged down into building this stuff, you're not doing the important stuff? I don't know. I don't know.
It's tough. It almost feels like I mean, we've been through a lot of hype cycles recently with technology in general, right? And people are very excited about AI at the moment, so something to keep in mind.
Something to keep in mind. Make sure that you have a good use case for it before you invest a whole ton of time and effort and dollars, and then kind of come out the other side and go, wait a second, what's the value of this thing? I don't know, right? Oh, did you see this too? I know it's not in my list, but the AI pin. Remember the AI pin? I think Humane. I saw this, and I should have. There's something wrong with the charging case. It can like light on fire or something. So they basically told you to stop. I kind of at some
Don't
point,
wear
I
it.
yeah, don't wear it. Don't charge it. You have a brick now. I kind of.
Wow.
I there's almost a point where I get to a point where I kind of feel bad, because this is a great example of the hype cycle, right? Like I remember when this came out, everybody's like, oh my God, you can wear it on your shirt, and it tells all this, does everything for you, and it just seems to be, getting smacked one time after another, ever since they made that first video, and everybody was like, this is cool, and then it's just been shit news after shit news ever since, it feels like. With particularly with that device, right? So,
Well, that's not the only device that's had issues, right? And do you remember the Rabbit
the
MQ?
rabbit, yeah.
Yeah.
What's
It
happened
turns
to
out to be
that?
a
Is it
scam.
pretty much dead at this point?
Pretty much. It turns out they overpromised and underdelivered and to an extreme degree. So like it's not even it's just a it's a underpowered phone basically that runs an app. And that's about it.
I guess this is are we in the hype cycle right now where there's just a lot of stuff that's going around that's profiteering? I don't know if is the right word to use, but just making gains because this is so popular right now and everybody wants to try the new thing. I wonder how long it'll take to kind of get all of that stuff dealt with, and then sort of more serious outcomes here with Gen AI. I don't know.
I think it'll stay. Well, I mean, we're already seeing huge progress in a lot of research areas, right? And that's where I've been most excited to see. So, there's a couple of articles we have today about that as well. So,
Okay, so let's move on. We'll get to those. I thought this was interesting. So this has been making the rounds on the socials this week. And I just thought I'd include it. So basically, the story that I've heard, and again, it's only been little slices of things that people are posting on social media and stuff, but it basically was like, no, I didn't do that. But yeah, these chips are going over here. So basically, the story is that there were a whole bunch of GPUs meant for Tesla that were redirected to X for X's AI tools. So in one whatever they call it now, I'll just call it a post. No, I didn't say that. And then the second one was, that this is why we're doing it. So kind of weird. It's been all over the technology news this week, but it's no small number. I think in the article there's a mandate. So the mandate is that by the end of the year, Musk wants 100,000 H100 GPUs available to X.
Wow.
Okay. Making it sort of one of the largest clusters of GPUs in the world. And the gist of this article was that there were 12,000 GPUs heading to Tesla that were redirected over to X. I don't, you know, again, I think a lot of this is whoops, we lost Travis. One second. You back? Oh, I don't have audio now. Hang on a second. What happened? I have two of you in the... We're having a little technical issue here. We'll be... just give us a sec. We'll see if Travers rejoins. There you go. Okay. I had two of you. I had one of you and then one of you in the green room, and I could hear neither of you. I was just saying that I think a lot of this just is clickbait and, you know, oh my God, look at this horrible stuff that's happening. It's no small number, obviously. It says here in the article that the value of those H100s, 12,000 of them, is about $500 million.
So very expensive GPUs.
Yeah. And
is that right? Does it say they were just sitting around in a warehouse?
Well, that's the comment. The comment was, yeah, if I didn't move them over here, they would have just sat in a warehouse because we didn't have the ability to use them, I guess, at this point. I don't know. You'll never really know the truth of this, but just right. Because it was making the rounds, I thought, and we like to talk about the chip wars and stuff. So I guess
right.
They're fighting internally for chips now too, even it sounds like. So there we go.
Within the Muskiverse.
Yes. Yeah. I like struggle. It. So let's get on to the cooler stuff that's less social media clickbait. Walk us through right. these interesting sort of research-oriented articles that you found here. First one is about weather forecasting.
Yeah, so using generative AI to quantify uncertainty in weather forecasting. It's a Google research paper. They're calling the technology Seeds, and they're using it to accelerate and improve weather forecasts with diffusion models. So the thing with forecasting weather, the state of the art before this, was it's extremely computationally expensive to run the models. Which means it's extremely financially expensive, right? It takes time and energy to run those predictions. But it turns out that what you can do is you can leverage the corpus of weather data, of historical weather data, and use the diffusion element of generative AI. So kind of that you start with a patch of noise and you condense it down into something that's useful, right? Mm-hmm. Which is how most large language models work. And image generations work, right? So what you can do is you can actually create a prediction model that is slightly more efficient than the state of the art and way less expensive to run, because you just have to train it on these on this historical data instead of this generated computationally intensive model data for weather prediction. So yeah. I think they're making these services available.
So you generally. you can like, when you say available, is this something I can do my own weather predictions?
I wonder. I'd be interested to see. I know that the flood forecasting is, which is the next paper.
Yeah.
Spoiler, but
yeah.
Yeah, Seeds leverages the power of GenAI to produce ensemble forecasts comparable to those from the operational U.S. forecast system, but at an accelerated pace. So. The results they reported, they need only 2 seeding forecasts from the operational system to get 31 forecasts in the current version, to give you an idea of like the scale and efficiency wow. gains you get by doing this. So you can use, you know, a lot less of that computationally intense data.
So just to potentially rain on this a little bit, see what I did there?
Yeah.
How nice. Yeah. How, like, I would hate to be a person that is charged right now with predicting weather. I think it's probably got to be one of the most thankless jobs. Like, I don't know how many times today my Echo has said it's gonna rain. and then it doesn't rain. And
right.
like, again, I'm seeing here, it's been telling me it's going to rain on and off all day. Now it's telling me it's not until 6 p.m. I wonder, like, I'd be interested, does this, those 31 forecasts that it can generate out of the two seed forecasts, I'd be interested to know kind of in the end, you know, how many of those generated forecasts were of, I don't want to say of like value. I think they're all value, but how accurate are they? Right. Cause it's gotta be really tough with climate change and stuff nowadays to even remotely predict what is going to happen in the next 2 hours, let alone, what'd you say? 10 days, I think.
Right. Well, you know what I mean? Weather is an extremely hard problem for that reason, because the system is so chaotic, right? You have to deal with, I mean, you're dealing with the atmosphere, there's air currents, heat change, temperature changes, humidity changes, everything, all of that entails. So, but it seems like here, we're looking at the results section and they're claiming it's more accurate than the traditional method.
Yeah. Well, you know what? The technology itself, to your point, like, it's just, before this, computationally intensive, very expensive to do. If they're able to reduce the time it takes to do these things and reduce the cost, then obviously there's lots and lots of benefits in being able to generate these different potentials in rapid succession at a very low cost, right? So lots of value here, I'm sure.
Because essentially what they're doing is they're extrapolating potential future weather states from the computationally intense simulation data.
Yeah, that's cool. So I'm going to skip over. No, I'm not. I'm going to go to the flood forecasting one. Walk us through the flood forecast.
So the flood forecasting is interesting because it's using, again, I guess it kind of has to do with weather and rainfall, but rainfall is hard to predict in the short term, right? Or short term and long term. Mm-hmm. So what they've done is they're making this available. They're using local data from maps pictures essentially and making it available to predict kind of what areas might be at risk for flooding.
When you say maps, are you talking about like Google Maps or basically like taking satellite data and feeding it in?
Yeah, essentially you take satellite data. Let's see. You take a model identifies whether rivers expected to flood by processing publicly available data sources. So it also takes in precipitation weather basin data and it puts out a forecast of river level, basically, to predict whether you might have experience a flood in that area. And again, using historical data to kind of train models to predict that.
You know, this goes back to kind of like what you mentioned earlier on, like the real value of this stuff, Gen AI, is all about providing people with access to this type of information. Like arguing about where GPUs go and stuff makes for great social media posts, but
it does.
This is where like the true value of this, like think about, like it says here, Flood Hub currently covers river basins in 80 countries, providing critical flood forecasting for over 1,800 sites and population of 460 million people.
Yeah. And in like, a lot of cases, it's better predictions than you get from the local data. So,
yeah, like that's like, these are use cases that you can see true value, kind of like along the medical research that we've talked about and stuff like that, providing this type of information and tools to make people's lives better. This stuff's pretty incredible when you think about it.
Yeah. Like I saw another paper that was about predicting the effects of contrails, because planes will leave trails essentially of exhaust that can have a detrimental impact, a warming effect for a long time after they pass through. Mm-hmm. And apparently the thesis of the paper was that if you reduce the altitude of the flight by a small margin, you get drastically reduced effects. It's like 50% of the warming effect, and it costs about 0.3% more fuel efficiency, which is a big deal for airlines.
Yeah,
but it, you know, is that a cost you're willing to spend, I guess, is the question. Yeah, also you see these things used to predict forest fires, like using satellite data and temperature data to predict natural disasters, essentially, I think is another really important use case.
Going to be super valuable, especially again to comment I made earlier on, just as the climate continues to change, right? Being able to forecast this, give people some level of heads up warning, you know, before something really goes sideways. Because I guess, we're going to see more and more unusual weather events. So being able to give
Yeah,
somebody a bit
unfortunately.
of heads up time is super valuable. Really cool. And then we've got the last one here
Oh,
is.
yeah. So this is kind of interesting. Again, I picked a theme here, but this was like NVIDIA posting. They did a lot of updates. Jensen Huang was saying that he wanted the company to essentially be run by AI eventually. So they're moving heavily into kind of the simulation training space for robotics. But also they released this model that was like extremely hyper-localized weather prediction. So like in your city block kind of situation, like down to that level. I don't know if the video.
Want me to jump ahead a little bit?
Sure.
Let's see if we can find it's kind of zooming in here. I don't know if it. Do you pick up
Yeah, we want
my system audio? I don't
to.
think you do. I'll make
No, there's
sure
no
that
audio coming through for me, but
I think I could fiddle around with it, but I'll just muck up all the audio and we'll be in worse shape than
here they're
we
going
are.
through it. They're like global forecast, there's a 25-kilometer resolution. Core diff, there's like a 2-kilometer resolution for weather data.
So yeah, you're talking about like you said, like city block type stuff.
Yeah. Well, more like I guess like city set sections.
That's pretty cool, eh? Again,
Yeah,
this
that's
is
really
where
interesting.
the real value of these models and being able to do these types of predictions, I think would continue to improve the quality of life for a lot of people.
Right. Like, what's the weather expected to be at your workplace tomorrow, right? So is it going to rain at your office? But
It's
like, look,
pretty
they're looking at micro effects, microclimate effects from airflow on
airflow.
skyscrapers here.
There's
So
a,
that's.
just on that, there's a really good, I'll see if I can find it, to Toronto City Hall, new City Hall, the
Oh, yeah.
one that's the wrapped building, right? It's kind of the,
Very
it's got a,
interesting structure, yeah.
yeah. And I remember way back in my university days, they did like a whole presentation on, and you can imagine this was a while ago, but just again, the effects of the shape of that building on airflow around the building for like other residents and people going about their day-to-day lives, moving past those spaces. I don't recall the details of it now, but I remember they had done a lot of modeling like what they had shown there, obviously not like they do nowadays, but that whole idea of just being able to understand the weather patterns, the air patterns, wind
Right.
patterns around that building. They spent a lot of time doing that because they weren't quite sure what the effects of building, placing a building like that would be on the surroundings. It was kind of neat. So it's neat to see that in that video there where you're seeing the airflow, the air currents around those tall buildings. Kind of neat.
Well, sure, because it could have a big effect on local weather. It's the air flow through the neighborhood, right? Gets massively impacted.
Very good. I did, just to switch back from the true usefulness of this, I forgot to add a link when I was clicking through and setting up the browser. There was a
Oh, yeah.
link, we were talking about OpenAI, and is it called Sora? Is it Sora, the text to video thing? There was, I think it's this week at a film fest, maybe in Europe, where they are sort of premiering 15-minute movies that are completely made by AI. So OpenAI is I think co-sponsoring some of it or something like that. So there's again an
Oh,
example of
sure.
how they're making sure they're staying ahead of everybody else in the news cycle. So that'll be interesting to see what happens there. But then I stumbled across an article that was from Ashton Kutcher, I think is how you say
Oh,
his
yeah.
name, right? And he was mentioning about how he thinks in very short order, most movies will be Gen AI. And his comment was something along the lines of like, if I needed to take a shot of a house, like in it for a movie, why would I want to do that in real life? Because it's going to cost like tens of thousands of dollars to go out on set and do all that. And I could instead just use describe text to build that out. And it would cost me $100 and I don't need anything like
Well,
studios or
sure.
anything like that. And then the other comment was, and I can't remember who the person was in the article, but they had basically said they had postponed plans to open a
It's Tyler
studio or
Perry.
ex that's it. Yeah, thank you. Or ex expand an existing studio because their thought was, holy crap, this is going to change a lot of stuff, and maybe we don't
Oh,
need
yeah.
all of this stuff. I'll make sure to include that one in the show notes. I lost it somewhere here. while I was cutting and pasting stuff over. But I just thought it was really interesting to see how people in the industries are starting to think about how this stuff is really going to affect what their day-to-day work looks like, right? So
this is going to be totally crazy for the film industry and for
massive disruption possibly, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's everything. Let's see. Oh, housekeeping. I'm playing a little catch up this month. We are going to do another webinar, probably last Thursday of the month. I'm not quite sure if I'm just going to recycle the intro to Gen AI one that we just did, or come up with something new to run through this month. The intro to Gen AI is up on our website now, so you can have a look at that. I'll make sure that I include the show notes to it, so you can check that one out. So that was the only housekeeping item I had. Did you have anything?
Nope, no housekeeping for me. I did watch Godzilla Minus One, and I highly recommend it. So,
yeah, I saw it, and I read a review or two about it, and people were saying it was a good movie.
Yep.
Yeah. Okay. Perfect. I have a couple for you. I have one good one and one meh one. So the first is a movie called Yummy, and I'm pretty sure Yummy. We found it on. I'm pretty sure it was on Shudder. So if you subscribe to Shudder, I'm pretty sure that's where it is. Essentially, it's a zombie movie. And it's kind of like it's a foreign film of some sort. I don't know country of origin, but basically they go to like a plastic surgery clinic to have some work done. And unknown to them in the basement, they are doing experimentation to help to sort of keep people from aging, and I'll leave it as, you know, it doesn't go like planned. And it's kind of like, it's one of those kind of comedy horror genre. Karen and I both had a couple good chuckles through the movie. So it's worth a watch. And my second one is Dune 2.
Yeah.
Did you watch the second Dune?
We watched it, and we watched it in what's the name of the seats that move? 5D or whatever.
Yeah.
And all I say is that you haven't watched Dune 2 until you've watched your friend try to take a drink from his his soda when Paul Atreides is riding the worm, and he's going like,
"That's fantastic." What did you think of the movie in general?
I liked it. I liked it. That was good.
Yeah, our general reaction was, meh, 3 hours? Yeah. Okay.
It's long.
I have a hard time watching a 90-minute movie, let alone a 180-minute movie. So we actually sliced it in two. I couldn't sit and watch it all. I don't have the ability to do that. I just can't. I don't know. I don't know. I think there was a lot of the cinematography was fantastic. The CGI was fantastic. Oh, yeah. I think they could have probably made that in an hour and a half movie without all the like wide sweeping views of things. Maybe if I saw it in a chair that was shaking as I was trying to drink a pop, or maybe on IMAX or something like that. Like a friend of ours saw it on an IMAX screen, and she said it was absolutely fantastic. I just streamed it, so I thought it was pretty good, but the CGI in it, the ships and stuff like that,
so good,
pretty fantastic. So I don't know, I have a hard time stomaching a three-hour movie. I just can't make myself do it. So
it's a lot.
Yeah, I think I might read the books though. I read the books when I was like a teenager. I might go back and reread them.
Classic.
Just to kind of go through the story in maybe more detail than what you can get on the big screen, right? Or on the medium-sized screen for us.
Right.
Yeah. Awesome. All right. Well, that is the show for another week. And we'll be back next Thursday at the same time, about 2 p.m. Eastern, barring any sort of technical difficulties or multitasking on my part that makes us start late. But we'll be back next week with all the latest news. So until then, bye.